So just imagine with me, if you will, if you were back then and listening to the famous whiskey speech. My friends, I had not intended to discuss this controversial subject at this particular time. However, I want you to know that I do not shun controversy. On the contrary, I will take a stand on any issue at any time, regardless of how fraught with controversy it might be. You have asked me how I feel about whiskey. All right, here is how I feel about whiskey. If when you say whiskey, you mean the devil's brew, the poison scourge, the bloody monster that defiles innocence, dethrones reason, destroys the home, creates misery and poverty, yea, literally takes bread from the mouths of children. If you mean the evil drink that topples Christian men and women from the pinnacle of righteous, gracious living to the bottomless pit of degradation, despair, and shameless and helplessness and hopelessness, then certainly I am against it. But if, when you say whiskey, you mean the oil of conversation, the philosophic wine, the ale that is consumed when good fellows get together, that puts a song in their hearts and laughter on their lips and a warm glow of contentment in their eyes, if you mean Christmas cheer, if you mean the stimulating drink that puts the spring in the old gentleman's step on a frosty, crisp morning, if you mean the drink which enables a man to magnify his joy and happiness and to forget, if only for a little while, life's great tragedies and heartaches and sorrows, if you mean the drink the sale of which pours into our treasuries untold millions of dollars, which are used to provide tender care for our little crippled children, our blind, our deaf, our aged and infirm, to build highways and hospitals and schools, then certainly I am for it. This is my stand. I will not compromise.
That speech really gets at the conflict, the controversy that our society has when it comes to alcohol. Is it appropriate to drink it, good and bad? And that's what we're tackling today. It's a pretty big topic and something I really think is going to be a great, great weekend. And to do that, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to interview a friend of mine, Jack Wilson, who is a PhD in counseling psychology. He's taught in this area and trained in this area of substance abuse for over 30 years. And every time I sit with Jack, and you're going to find the same thing today, there's just wisdom from his life and from his training and teaching. So we decided to bring him in and say, let's talk about this issue of alcohol. So first question, Jack, would be this. You know the whiskey speech. You brought it to us. So there's that debate of good and bad. How do you look at this whole thing in alcohol in our society?
Yeah, that's the reason I really like that particular speech, because it does do such a good job of summing up, you know, all the ways of looking at alcohol and the ways our society looks at it. And I really believe both sides are correct. If you are a moderate user of alcohol, if you don't have a physiological predisposition where it becomes dangerous to you, I have no objections to appropriate use of alcohol. But we have to always be cognizant and aware that there are individuals out there for whom, because of a variety of different factors which we'll talk about, it's simply not safe for them to consume alcohol. But we don't want to just talk about the individual who has the problem with alcohol. We also want to make sure that we take a look at the impact that it has on their family, because this becomes a spiritual issue, a moral issue that has great impact on everybody around the person who is doing the drinking, all the way out to the larger society.
What are the stats? I mean, what kind of, you know, what's going on in our culture right now in regards to alcohol, in families, individuals, whatever?
Well, what we know is the approximate percentage that most professionals are comfortable with is 15% of the population have serious issues when they consume alcohol. It's a little tricky, though. I said 15% of the population, but that doesn't address people who don't drink. There are a lot of people out there who don't drink, and they're not in our statistics in terms of problem drinkers. But what we do know is individuals, let's say from within that 15% who have difficulty with alcohol, 35% of them, fully 35% of them, would fit any definition of alcoholism that we could possibly come up with.
Now, how would you define an alcoholic?
Well, there's always been a lot of argument. I even think it's a canard about whether the alcoholism is a disease or is not. And I'm just going to say, yes, it is. I don't want to take a lot of time on that. But it is a disease, and it's a disease that is characterized by a loss of control. It's progressive, and if it continues through its progression, it's fatal. Let me give you an example. What I mean by that is society, much like the whiskey speech, we're confused. We have an image of an alcoholic as being the derelict, the skid row bum. That's not the typical alcoholic. Alcoholism exists on a continuum from an individual because of some predisposition is beginning to develop the disease, and that's where we want to step in, that's where we want to have an impact.
Which blows the myth, because the college guy who can drink everybody under the table is the stud. You're the man because you can hold more alcohol, and you're saying that guy or that gal is actually in more trouble than the guy I can't drink a beer to.
Yeah. The other thing that we see is people who won't go or won't be involved in a social activity or an event unless alcohol is served. The guy that won't play on the slow pitch team, you know, or the girl that won't go to the party. Just think of all the things you've heard, you and Ann have sat in a room when you're doing premarital counseling, the debate over serving or not serving alcohol at the reception. Well, if we don't serve alcohol at the reception, my uncles won't come.
Exactly.
Okay. See the power, you know, that culture begins to exhibit and how normative it becomes. Well, whenever I hear those kinds of things, then as a professional, I start going, we better ask some more questions here, because it looks to me like we're beginning to move into the area of significant alcohol abuse.
Yeah. When does a person decide it would be safe for me or it would not be safe for me to even become a social drinker, maybe?
What I would say for you as an individual or for anybody listening to this, do your own family tree. Go back at least two or three generations and look around to see whether there have been some folks that the family referred to as problem drinkers or Uncle Ned couldn't really handle his booze. Or, you know, and the closer it is to you, the more at risk you are of being in that 15% of people for whom alcohol can be a serious problem. So if one or more of your parents would be someone that you would think of that didn't handle alcohol well, created confusion in the family life because of it, then I would say that's a point at which you should be seriously considering the way you use alcohol.
Yeah.
Well, let's push that a little bit. What does that mean? Well, what that means is that if you have one or more parent who is an alcoholic, you have a 5 times higher probability of having the predisposition to this disease than someone who doesn't.
So I've heard you talk about the 3 P's. You just mentioned one of them. What are the other P's that you think of when you dig around your family tree?
Well, you when you're digging around and taking a look at things, you want to see what precipitates, you know, your drinking, and that's the culture that you grew up in. It's the advertising. It's the billions of dollars that we have in media. Frankly, I think most people in the room would agree the best and funniest TV ads, you know, are the alcohol ads. They do a great job. But that's all part of the precipitating thing in terms of that we as a culture say it's okay. We have some of the least restrictive laws as it relates to public drunkenness. We have some of the least restrictive laws as it comes to drunken driving. Most of the other countries in the world are nowhere near as tolerant. That's a precipitating issue. And then the next issue becomes the perpetuation of the issue. You know, are you going to continue doing it? And when we look at perpetuating, we come to another diagnostic category, which is extremely important, and it's really kind of the capstone category, and that's, do you continue drinking in spite of negative consequences? If you have had a couple of negative consequences and you cut way back, stop drinking, don't drink at all, become what we would call a moderate drinker, then that's something that you've made as a good judgment. But if you have something in your genetic makeup, then the likelihood is that you're going to continue drinking in spite of the negative consequences.
So, I mean, this whole series we're in called Crave, that would apply to any one of the craves we've talked about, food, sex, today talking about alcohol. Why does a person, from your perspective, who has negative consequences with drinking or any of the others, continue to do it?
Your brain's actually changed. And your brain is set up in such a fashion or a condition that it craves the alcohol. and we refer to it as the point at which you tip over. And I can't tell you for any individual when that tip over point's going to come. I'm a very strong believer that many people are born alcoholic because they're 2 ounces, 3 ounces in the womb, and their mom has a beer every day. Whoops. That's a tremendous amount of alcohol, and if you have any element of precipitation in there, so many, many young people start their life that way.
Yeah, but as I look back on my past, it's like, okay, so I'm in college deciding to drink, and realizing in myself this, what would you call it, this desire to not have two beers, to go to the third and the fourth. Every time I drank, it was never one. It was always like, let's go farther. But until I heard you talk about this, I never connected dots like predisposition, you know, my past, thinking almost every single night of my life from 5, 6, 7, 8 years old to 17, 18 years old, always seeing mom and dad with a glass of vodka or gin every night. So, you know, for someone like me, if I came into you and said, hey, Jack, do you think I should drink? What advice would you give a guy like me?
The advice that I would give you is to remember the Paisley song does a really good job of talking about the personality of alcohol. And the personality of alcohol is it's cunning, it's baffling, it's powerful, and it's infinitely patient. The fastest growing segment of people that fit the diagnosis of alcoholism today are people over the age of 55. And it's going up faster up in each age group beyond that. We have the two groups that we're most concerned about in terms of getting information out there, and that's the young, you know, and the folks over 55. So I know you're not over 55,
but I
would think
Long
with
way.
Your... with your family tree,
yeah.
It just is something that I would say, don't do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the amazing thing from in my story, and I'm guessing a lot of people this weekend, light bulbs are going on right now. You may have your schedule full of people coming in, but, you know, just connecting some of the dots, it's like, I never was told this, never thought, okay, so I had an alcoholic mom and dad that would, you know, I'm like, I'm not them. Even though it split up our home, I'm not them, I can handle it and get... And so I made a decision based on just wise counsel to not have alcohol in my home. It just is like, duh. Now, I know there's some people probably sitting out there going, well, I didn't have alcoholic parents. I can handle it. What do you say to them? Maybe they can. Is that what you say? Or?
Well, I'd say to them, take a look at your life.
Yeah.
Is the consumption of alcohol getting in your way? Is it interfering? If it's getting in your way, if it's interfering, if it's causing problems in your marriage, if it's causing problems at work, then I would ask you to do a simple little thing. Now remember, simple and easy aren't synonyms, okay? But I'm going to ask you to do a simple little thing. Don't drink for 30 days.
At all?
At all. And as you make the decision to be free of alcohol for 30 days, take a look to see how you feel about that, okay? And if at the end of that 30 days, talk to someone who has background or experience in the area, and you may come to the conclusion that, yeah, things are okay. Or you may come to the conclusion, I had a little bit of more of an issue here than I thought that I did.
Now talk about the person that's affected by alcohol in their home or in a friendship or a relationship at work, that they're not the one drinking, but they're living close in a relationship or, you know, some kind of relationship with somebody that is. What do they do? How do they make a difference? How do they help this person see? Can they? Or they just throw up their hands like this and say, there's nothing I can do?
The biggest... thing that that I really want people to take home is that term hostage. It sounds almost brutal, okay? But I want the people to take home the word hostage, and I want them to do an evaluation of themselves. Have they and the rest of the family become hostage to alcohol? And that's the first step. If you accept the fact that you truly are not in a relationship with this person, you're just simply hostage to their alcohol, that'll cause a mind change almost immediately. From there, then, there are a variety of different things. You know, our recovery groups here on Monday nights do a really good job of helping people whose lives have been made unmanageable because of somebody else's drinking. There's Al-Anon for people. Al-Anon's an amazing group that was actually started by the wife of the guy who created Alcoholics Anonymous because she wasn't real sure what to do once he got into recovery because she'd been codependent, co-alcoholic, whatever term you want to use, for so many years, that she also had stopped growing and stopped maturing. So it's really important to spend time with people who've been down the road, you know, who've been there in front of you, and to get their wise counsel.
So that community aspect is huge. I mean, we've said it every week in this series, but hopefully people hear that, to go to a safe place where other people know the struggle and can share with you and go forward, hopefully, right?
Correct.
So many people that drink don't think they have a problem, so they're not willing to admit they have a problem. What do you do with a person like that, especially if that's somebody you're in a relationship with?
Well, let me just say one thing that, again, might be controversial, but I've been doing this for 30 years.
You're good at the controversial.
I've never met an alcoholic who didn't know they were an alcoholic. Mm. It's just that they haven't been willing to face it yet. It's just that they haven't been willing to turn it over.
Okay? So you're saying deep in their soul, they know there's a problem here.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah. But the personality of the hostage taker is so strong that it blocks them from doing anything about it. My experience is that people who are the low bottoms, the folks that are not at the physiological dependency level yet, which is not necessarily a synonym there, so I want to be careful. Yes, there are low bottoms that need to be detoxed. But the low bottoms seem to be willing to accept a recommendation or a suggestion that they go to an AA meeting. What a great place to start. If you think you're beginning to have issues and concerns with alcohol, AA is everywhere. Three meetings a day at least, you know, and places all over.
Yeah.
So if someone tells you they can't get to an AA meeting, whoops, sure they can.
Yeah.
They're everywhere. And what a wonderful place to start in terms of beginning to get an idea in terms of looking at life, you know, without alcohol. That's the part of it. The issue in terms of the family and the people who are concerned and affected, you asked me about the wife or the husband. You should hold that person accountable for their conduct. And if you are a wife or husband and you are committed in the sickness and health, and yet this is a disease, then I think that a very important step is some form of an intervention, some form of bringing people together who can sit down with the individual and honestly say to that individual, this is the way your drinking is negatively affecting my life. You know, this is the way your drinking is getting in the way of us being able to move forward as a family. You know? And a variety of people can and should be involved. Most folks who talk about the recovery process will tell you that that hearing from their coworkers and their bosses was a much more powerful thing than hearing from members of their family.
Really?
You know, there are people out there now through the different services that are mentioned in the materials we're giving out who have intervention specialists on staff who can teach you how to do a beginning stage intervention who actually can come in and run an intervention in your home for you if it's something that you would prefer to have a professional do.
Yeah, because it sounds to the typical person pretty scary to think that I would confront my dad or my spouse without a little help. Like you said, with some skilled professionals or people at least have done it. Have you seen those done, some kind of intervention? Like you said, it's better to have just more than just family members there. Do you see success?
If there's a plan.
Really?
There has to be a plan. If I say to you, I'm concerned about your use of alcohol, and I don't have a plan, I wasted your time and my time. I may even have raised the risk for you. So I have to be in a situation where, and that's where, you know, talking to an intervention specialist, I have to be in a situation where someone who is a recovering person can say, and as soon as this is over, I want you to go to this AA meeting with me. Or the intervention specialist can say, and this is the treatment program we're recommending for you. We already have the airplane ticket. You're on your way to wherever, you know, or I'll drive you there myself, or I want to take you to the emergency room to start the detoxing process, because there needs to be a plan right there so that the individual can see that it wasn't just smoke, because she's been told so often, stop drinking, stop drinking.
Yeah.
We want this to actually be an intervention.
Wow.
And the intervention needs to be honest. But you need to use common sense in the intervention, but you also have to have compassion, because I don't know anybody who wants to be an alcoholic. No 25-year-old or 15-year-old or 55-year-old said, oh, I think I'll wake up tomorrow and destroy my life. What a great idea.
Yeah.
No. So you have to... Sorry. I've seen this kill so many people. The compassion grows out of knowing that that individual is lonely, they're isolated, and they really want help. And the compassion also operates along the line. There's good news. People by the tens of thousands gain control over this disease and go on to lead full, beautiful, balanced lives.
So what happened?
You know, I've known Jack Wilson for, Jack and Kathy actually, for 14 years. They've been at Kensington for that. In fact, he was sitting here at the last service and had many, many discussions with Jack, Ann and I both. Just incredible wisdom, incredible skill. I mean, he's helped us raise our boys, just helping us as parents. It's been amazing. But I'll tell you what, in 14 years and many, many conversations, sitting by lake, sitting in his office, wherever, I have never seen Jack Wilson crack like that, just break down. I didn't see it coming in the interview. I was just sitting there. All of a sudden, it's like, what just happened? And Jack said what happened. He saw faces of people that have been killed, families destroyed, kids' lives wrecked by this thing called the bottle. And he said also he was breaking because he's seen people come out and get free. So there's both sides of this thing called alcohol. And I tell you what, our culture is an interesting culture when you talk about alcohol. Every one of us in some way has a relationship with alcohol. It is predominant in our culture. Always has been. It's very interesting how strong and how available it is to any age in our culture today. It's really true. In fact, Monday, I sat in my office with Dan Sadler, who's speaking right now at our Troy campus, and two sisters, Jean and Mary, who came in to tell me their story. I knew about their story a little bit, but didn't know all the details. And it's amazing. Just two women have been in our congregation for years, both married guys who are budding, you know, successful young men. One was a great athlete in Clarkston, very well known, got into business and did really well. Jean married a guy. She was the older sister, and she married a guy. Same thing, good-looking guy, very successful. Jean and Mike had two daughters. Mary and Eugene had two sons, and just great families. And neither one of them knew that their husbands would both have drinking problems. As young couples, they did what most young couples did. They went to parties, and at the parties were drinks, and they drank, and it was no big deal. Everybody there had a beer or two or a glass of wine. It's no big deal. But over the years, Jean first and then Mary second began to realize, my husband has a problem with this. He doesn't just drink at the parties anymore. Mary, in fact, sent me her journal, and in her journal, it's very interesting. She began to find bottles hidden around the house, bottles even in a car seat. In the garage. Jean, same thing. There began to be signs and symptoms. Both these men were confronted that they had a problem. Both denied it. Both died because of alcohol. Not from a wreck, not from a decision. Their body was wrecked because they would not stop drinking. Mike died 3 years ago, and Eugene, his brother-in-law, said at the funeral to Mary, I will stop right now. I just saw Mike, one of his best friends, die from this. I will stop. He died 6 weeks ago. Couldn't stop. And I'm not, I mean, I read Mary's journal of the days in the hospital at Beaumont as she just watched her husband's liver shut down for cirrhosis and just his brain. It was horrific. It's horrible. In fact, they both sent me letters and notes, and I actually asked them if I could read some of their stuff to you. And let me show you a picture of Mike. This is Mike and his two daughters. Now you look at him and you realize, okay, he's not the typical what you think of a guy who's an alcoholic, that he has a problem, he's down and out, and he carries around a little brown bag with a wine bottle in it. This is a very successful man. And one of the things Jean wrote I thought was just profound. This is right sort of in the battle. She wrote a letter to alcohol. And I'll just read you one paragraph. It says, "To alcohol, you have destroyed my family. You have taken the man that I married nearly 10 years ago and turned him into a complete stranger, a cruel, mean, heartless stranger. He can only focus on one thing, alcohol. He can't focus on his two beautiful daughters. You have stolen that from him. You have stolen their father from them. They have never known a healthy father. You came into our lives and took all of the normal, healthy bonds that exist in a family, and you drowned them. For that, I feel complete hatred for you." You know, Dan and I, as we sat with Mary and Jean, just bawled. I remember sitting with Mary and Eugene. Here's a picture of Eugene and Mary and their kids about 3 or 4 years ago for marriage counseling. I'm not a very good marriage counselor. I told you that. I couldn't help them. And, you know, somewhere in that discussion that day, the addiction came out. And I remember just saying, "Dude, you got to stop." And he didn't. Here's one of Mary's writings. It says, "Because of the bottle, my boys only had their father for 8 and 10 years. Because of the bottle, I must raise these boys without their father. Because of the bottle, these boys will never have the chance to learn how to be a man from their father, nor will they learn to cook from him or paint or fish or garden. Because of the bottle, my boys don't have a daddy at their baseball games, school events, band concerts." You know, I read that last night at a Troy campus, and when I read that line, it hit me. My dad didn't die from alcohol, but it had the same effect on his son, me. Dad never came to a baseball game, never came to a school event, never came to a band concert. I was at a rock band, never came, saw me play, even though he was a drummer that got me into music, never saw me play. Why? Because alcohol took him from our family. "Because of the bottle, my boys were cheated out of the opportunity to witness a lifelong healthy relationship between a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, their daddy and their mommy. Because of the shame attached to that bottle, that man would not, could not, did not get the help he needed soon enough." I mean, it was an amazing story. Now, here's the thing that happens when most of us hear a story like that. We think this, well, that's not me. I mean, I can drink and it's no problem. I will never kill myself with a bottle. And you know what? Most of you won't. It isn't a very high percentage of people that actually drink themselves to death. People get car drunk driver, and, you know, we do stupid things, but not too many people drink themselves to death like they did. So it's easy for us sometimes to go, well, that's not me. Here's what we need to address this weekend. You've got to decide what you're going to do with alcohol. You've got to make that decision. Because our culture doesn't even really talk about it, and we just play the game. Do you realize that if you have any kind of history of alcohol problem in your family tree, and by the way, let me stop right there. If you've never dug around your family tree, you have to. If you've never done that exercise, you have to. Because it really relates to the decision that you will make regarding alcohol. You know, you heard a little bit of my story in the video, but, you know, it's really interesting for me. When you grow up around it, you don't even see it. I mean, I knew my dad drank, and I knew he was an angry drunk. Some were happy and fun. He was angry. He'd get mad and abusive and yell and scream, and it was ugly. And it broke our family apart. So I basically grew up, most of you know this, with just my mom. Just my mom and I. We moved to Ohio, and my older brothers and sister were off to college and then into their lives. And I had a younger brother who died of leukemia. So it was just mom and me. That was it, just the two of us. And when I started dating Ann, I was a senior in college. She was going into her freshman year in college. We start dating. I bring her home. First time I'd ever brought her to our house and spent the evening with my mom watching TV. And we get in the car and we're driving home. And Ann says to me this. This is how normal and abnormal don't even see the difference. And by the way, I'm saying that Ann's normal. And we all know she isn't. And her family isn't. But, you know, she says to me as we're driving home, she goes, "So does your mom drink every night?" And I'm like, "What are you talking about? My mom doesn't drink." She goes, "Dave, she was drinking right there in front of us." I'm like, "No, that she's not drinking alcohol. There was a glass, clear liquid. I guarantee you it was alcohol because she was drunk. I never could see it." She wasn't drunk because she could carry on a conversation. She seemed pretty normal. She goes, "I'll bet you she was drunk." In fact, Ann said to me, this is one of our early dates. She goes, when you go home tonight, why don't you just take a sip and see what it is? I go, I will. Sort of like I was mad at her, like, I'll prove you. She's not drinking. My mom and dad drank when I was little, but she stopped. And my dad's still drinking, but he's not here anymore. My mom doesn't drink. Well, I went home, and my mom was asleep on the Lazy Boy, which she did every night. Now I realize she passed out. Many nights I would carry her to bed and put her to sleep. She had a major pancreatic surgery while I was in high school. Never connected the dots. How blind can you be? And when I put her to bed, I went back to the chair and I took a sip. Ian was right. Pure. No dilution at all. Vodka, gin, I don't remember. And I realized, oh my gosh, my mom is passing out every night. You would have never known? I didn't even know. Now, as you dig around your family tree, which I didn't do until seminary, I'm in a counseling class, first day of class, the teacher says, we're going to do each other's family trees. So Ann and I went home, we're both in that class together. She's doing her family tree, and she's like, look, I got this great ancestry, we're all normal. I'm like, none of you are normal, look at this, look at this. But when you looked at mine, can you believe this? I was 25, 26 years old, never had really done this. Alcohol, dad and mom, grandparents, sexual abuse, adultery, divorce, rampant through my thing. And so we go back there and they say, whatever's in your family tree, you need to take a real hard look at. Because if you have one alcoholic parent, Jack said it, you are five times more likely to have a problem with alcohol. I told you in the video, I always had a problem with alcohol. I would never call it a problem. I just say, hey, dude, I'm the party. I can drink. I can drink with anybody. I can drink more than anybody. I never wanted one. I wanted three or four or five or keep going. I would get in a car a little buzzed. That's a problem. Anybody that's ever done that even one time, guess what I'm telling you the truth? You have a problem with alcohol. And if you've never done your family tree, do it this week. Do it today. It's not that hard to do. You probably know most of the answers or make some phone calls and you can do it. So for the Wilsons, what would we decide? I said it in the interview. There's not alcohol in our home. We'd be idiots to have alcohol in our home. Why would I have a bottle, even one, in my home? Not going to do it. Made a decision, never, not going to do it. You know what's interesting, parents? I want to say something to you parents. Think hard about this. What are you modeling? What are you making available to your kids? They will copy you. You can drink, no problem. Can you? You know, Jack told me this study was done with middle school age kids and their parents. Separate rooms. They asked the middle school age kids, 6th, 7th, 8th graders, if you've drank, why did you drink? And by the way, one out of three 14-year-olds have already drank. I've already been drunk. And he said, so why do you drink? And they asked the parents the same thing. You know what the parents said? Our kids, if they've drank because they wanted to fit in or be cool or feel grown up. You know what the kids said? One reason, to get drunk. We drank to have a good time and get drunk. And then they asked them, where did you get the alcohol? Guess where? At home. Parents' cabinet. Or our friends' parents. That's where they get it. Parents, think hard about this. Do you realize what happens to a 14-year-old if they have even one drink? They begin a relationship with alcohol. If they have the predisposition, 50% of people that started drinking before the age of 14 are alcoholics, 50%. I could have 10 of you stand up and put 5 of you down and say that many, if they drink one drink before the age of 14, will end up being an alcoholic. Why is that so scary? Because our bodies aren't made to drink at that age. Jack, explain this to me. I'm not a doctor, but the liver's not developed yet. The brain isn't even yet. That's why we have drinking laws that say 21. It isn't just so kids can't have fun. It's 21 because they're not even ready to drink yet because they can't handle it. And I live in Oakland County, and I go to banquets and graduation parties, and I am amazed at the alcohol that's there, even for our kids. You know, the cool thing now in Oakland County is going to spring break with your senior kids and drink. They're seniors. They're 18 years old, even though it's not legal to drink. They're a senior. They deserve this. We'll just go south, and we'll be there as parents with them to drink. Do you understand what we're doing? To use the analogies that Gene used in my office on Monday, it's like giving a kid or an adult a gun that has a bullet in it and say, go ahead and pull it. Maybe you have a predisposition, maybe you don't. We'll find out right now. You know, one of the things that we're not going to make a law about this at Kensington, but you know, sometimes I get an email that says, you know, I went to a Kensington small group and there was alcohol served or available at a Kensington event. And it's like, you guys need to take a position on that. You know what I'd say? Think hard about that. I'm not going to give a legalistic law because prohibition didn't even work and it wouldn't work here. But I'd say this, if you're leading a Kensington small group or a Kensington event and people are coming to your home or to this event and they're coming thinking this will be a Christ-centered event and alcohol is available, in a sense, I know this is a little bit of exaggeration, in a sense, you are handing everybody that walks in your house a gun. Some of them have bullets and say, go ahead, pull the trigger. Let's all do it together. Let's see who can drink this and not have a problem and who can. Because some of those people will drink it at your house because they're at a Christian event going, this must be okay. This is a Christian church event sponsored. Well, alcohol must be okay. Go ahead. Now, I'm not saying that alcohol is something that a person can never have a drink, but I'm saying think really, really hard about what you're doing and what you're modeling for others. Parents, if you are drinking in front of your kids or even around your home and you're thinking your kids aren't going to follow the same thing, they will. If you think that's okay, okay. But if they have problems later, you can't go, what are you doing? They'll just go, well, you did. I mean, really think really hard about this. You know, years ago, Ann reminded me about this on like Thursday or Friday as we're talking about this message. She goes, you remember the year? And I won't use any name, but we were getting to know these people and just got to know them a little bit. And they were older than us and their anniversary is coming up and we didn't know what to get them. We thought we'd get them something. And somebody had given us a bottle of wine as a gift, like 2 or 3 days before that. Well, we don't drink. So we still had it in our home and we're like, where are we gonna do this? And I'm Mr. Cheapo. So I said, let's just give them the bottle of wine. You know, we don't have to spend anything. And they'd probably like that for a 25th anniversary thing. So we wrapped it up and gave it to them. Never told them it was free. So we gave it to them. I don't even know if it's any good or not. I don't know good or bad wine. So we gave it to them and they said, thank you. And I don't know, 9, 10 months later, Ann was having lunch with the wife of this couple. And she said, you didn't know this, but when you gave us that bottle of wine, you had no way of knowing because we'd never talked about it, but I have a problem with alcohol and I can't drink. And so we got that bottle of wine and we were thankful and we said thanks. And she goes, I honestly hid it somewhere in my house and said, I can't go near it. And she said, I hate to tell you this, but one day, months later, when I was in just having a bad day and depressed, I drank the whole bottle. I mean, Anna, I'm like, we didn't know. Just American thing to do to give somebody. You don't know. You know what's really scary? It may be you and you don't even admit that you have a problem. This issue has to be talked about. Parents, think about this hard. Kids, middle school, high school, college, think about this. Do you really have to be cool and have that beer at the party? Do you really want to drink? Really? Do you understand the implications? Can you be a man? Can you be a woman that says, I don't drink and it's okay? You guys want to drink? Go ahead. I'm not judging you, not telling you how to live your life. I'm choosing for me not to drink for whatever reason. When I started making that choice after I became a follower of Christ, I was the biggest idiot, right? Used to be the party guy, used to drink on people under the table. Now I'm choosing not to. It was like, you loser. Really? Do you know how many of the guys I played college football with today still have a drinking problem and it started back then? Didn't even know it. You know, what's interesting for me is as I decided then, as I became a follower of Christ, to make some decisions morally about how I lived, sexually how I lived, language how I spoke, all the stuff. Drinking was one of the decisions I now had to decide what I'm going to do. This wasn't even about my history. This is about my Christian walk and my commitment to Christ. What do I do with alcohol? And I'll tell you what, I remember hearing a song by a guy. This guy, most of you have never heard his name. Anybody know the name Larry Norman? Anybody? Some of you know that name. Larry Norman was a rocker from the 60s and 70s that was pretty well known. I mean, the Beatles knew him. He was a known rocker that was an alcoholic and a drug abuser, just like everybody was. Had hair, blonde hair down to here. I mean, just freaky looking guy. Becomes a Christian. Radical, fanatical Christian in the middle of the entertainment world and starts to change his life and starts Christian rock. It was never heard of. In fact, the church banned him because he's drumming and playing loud music and electric guitars. He was a rebel. I'm telling you, if you like Christian contemporary music today, you can thank Larry Norman. He started it in the 60s and 70s with Randy Stonehill and some other guys. And I heard a song that he did about alcohol, and it's really his song because he battled that struggle. And he wrote a song about it that I'm actually going to do for you. And just picture me with hair down to my ankles, all right? And I'm not going to do the whole song, but I tell you what, listening to this song, which was sort of his journey, helped me make a decision about my journey, what I was going to do to alcohol. And I won't do the whole thing, obviously, but it's pretty interesting. It goes like this. Just picture drums, guitars. Anyway, it goes like this. The words are really powerful. Listen close. It goes like this. Sipping whiskey from a paper cup. You drown your sorrows till you can't stand up. Take a look at what you've done to yourself. Why don't you put the bottle back on the shelf? Yellow fingers from your cigarettes. Your hands are shaking while your body sweats. Why don't you look into Jesus? He's got the answer. Out all night, sleep all day. Hey, you take your money, throw it all away. Yeah. You say you're gonna be a superstar, but you never hung around enough to find out who you really are. Why don't you look into Jesus? He's got the answer. Why don't you look into Jesus? He's got the answer. Ah, yeah. Yeah, I can't believe you're clapping at that song, but I mean, hopefully you're clapping because it's like, whoa, there's a lot of truth in that song. And the real truth is the main point of the song. Why don't you look into Jesus? He really is the answer. Larry Norman discovered that. Still battled it his whole life, but he discovered that. In fact, he died a month ago. Battled it to his deathbed, knowing the truth, Jesus is the answer to the crave. You know, let me read you a couple quotes as I close this thing out. You know, I challenge you to make a decision. It's your choice. Kid, adult, all ages. Make a decision about alcohol. What are you going to do? And if you need some help, let me read you a couple quotes. One person said this. If you need an excuse for why you don't drink alcohol, it's pretty hard hitting. He said, you could say that addiction runs in your family and you don't want to try it even once because you may not stop until you are dead in a puddle of your own vomit. Or listen to this. Or smashed into the side of a minivan with children's body parts scattered around your corpse. Whoa. Now, that's pretty heavy, right? It's true. How about this one? I won't tell you who said this till afterwards, but this guy said this. He decided to stop. And he had a quote said this, I made a commitment to completely cut out drinking and anything that might hamper me from getting my mind and body together. And the floodgates of goodness have opened up upon me spiritually and financially. Guess who said that? You know him. If you go to movies, you know him. Denzel Washington doesn't drink. Decided not going to do it. You cool enough to be Denzel? You can make the same choice. Nobody's going to like your choice, but your choice is an amazing, true, freeing choice. You can do whatever you want, but every choice has consequences. Good choices, good consequences. Bad choices, bad consequences. When I go to parties where there's alcohol, I drink a Coke. It's not that hard. And I tell you what, I have a lot more fun than most people there. I really do. Actually, most people think I'm drunk. I'm not kidding. I'm hooping up and having a good time and they're thinking, he must be drinking. I don't need it. I really don't need it. And you don't either, if you're honest. Let me close with this. This whole series, you know, these represent sort of the things we've been looking at. From food to sex to this. I can hardly even look at that glass. Because it just takes me back to seeing that in my home. But any one of these can destroy your life if you're not careful. Any one. And they all are a crave for the same thing. What are we looking for? Whether it's any one of those or approval or any, you fill in the blank. We're all looking for the same thing. I want to fill up. I want to be happy. I want to find joy. I want to find meaning in my life. C.S. Lewis once said, any guy that knocks on the door of a brothel is really looking for God. He's right. They're looking for God. I think this act will do it. It may work for 5 minutes. It won't fill you up. Alcohol won't do it. You're looking for God. So let me close with this. You want us to go home, study this? Study this verse. John 7, 37, 38. It's going to come up here for you. Jesus, standing at a holy day, a holy feast, stands up and says, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Notice the word drink. You can drink or you can drink. You can drink alcohol or you can drink Jesus. One will leave you empty. The other will fill you. Oh, how much? He says, whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, streams of living water will flow from within him. You want life? I'm here to tell you where it is. Same place Larry Norman said. Why don't you look into Jesus? Okay, don't. Go home and live your life. Go ahead. Why don't you check out Jesus? You don't think he has the answer? How do you know? Find out. I'm telling you, just one guy. He is the and the only answer. And if you want to be filled up, drink from him. You'll overflow in a way I can't even describe to you. Overflow your life, and your life will overflow on your kids and others. He is the answer. End of story, end of series. Let's pray. Father God, I pray that we would know the truth. We would know the life. We would know the way is Jesus. Just as Larry Norman said years ago, Jesus, you are the answer. Father, I pray that even one person today would say, okay, today's it. I end this deal. I end this struggle. I end this addiction. I'm going to invest my life, surrender my life, submit my life to Jesus. Jesus, come in and fill me, as that verse just said. Would you flow? Would you overflow in my life? God, do that for some people today. Do that for Kensington. Help us to be a church of free, free in Christ people. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.